Why not? We're already in too far. The holograms disappeared to show a flat screen projecting a camera feed from an ODST's helmet. We have seen them in person before. Once. There's a lot of pertinent footage. But all you need to see is this. A blue stasis field faded away at the center of the ODST's heads-up display. A glance left showed a column of ODSTs with weapons ready. Easily 100 soldiers moving slowly forward toward the location where the stasis field had been. A Sharkoi standing on the dais in front of them shifted. It towered over them like a small building. Jai couldn't help thinking of a cyclops or troll from ancient human mythology. A massive pillar of lethality. Operation Polecat used Sangheili contacts and one trusted Sangheili crew on an ex-Covenant destroyer to hunt down a remote world where the prophets had allegedly kept their Sharkoi hive, Melody said. A handful of Sharkoi were found there. One was accidentally released while Oni personnel were trying to access the site's terminal data. The Sharkoi's head twisted. The eye-like bump on its head thrummed, probing and searching the air around it. It seemed to notice the weapons aimed at it, and bellowed. There may have been words in some strange alien tongue, but they were washed away by the immediate chattering of bullets as the ODSTs opened fire. The creature roared and leapt into the air, shattering any assumptions that it was slow and lumbering. The ODST's camera feed struggled to follow it as it landed in the middle of the column of shock troopers. Melody paused the footage just as the Sharkoi lifted up an ODST by his leg and smashed him between two fists, armor disintegrating under the impact. One Sharkoi alone killed 50 ODSTs during this operation. Later, the hive was nuked from orbit and then glassed by the Sangheili ship for good measure, Melody said. They're not something anyone at Oni wanted to get out. How come we've never heard of these things before? Adriana asked. How much do you know about the Forerunners? Only what we saw in briefings before Sunspear, Jai said. About the Master Chief and the Halo installation out in deep space. We believe that the Sharkoi were engineered by the Forerunners who built the Halo Array, Van Eekhout answered. And after the Sharkoi were first discovered by the Covenant, they were immediately hidden. No one really knew about them. They were created for protection against the Flood, a parasite that threatened all thinking life in the galaxy, as the Forerunners retreated into the galaxy's periphery. But evidently, only a few ever were discovered by the enemy. Fewer still used. During the war, some Sangheili and Sanshayum that knew about their existence begged their high prophets in secret to release them against the humans. But they never did. That's why we've never formally encountered them. So why didn't the prophets release them in battle? Jai asked. Van Eekhout smiled. The assumption is that they had the ability to release the Sharkoi, but they lacked the means to control them. The control device the Forerunners used was hidden away on one of their installations. The Covenant never had possession of it. If they had ever released them, it would have been only for raw power, a show of destruction and strength. The threat of Sharkoi was somewhat manageable before today. Before the Jerohanai chieftain Hecabe showed up. Hecabe? Mike asked. Who's this? Melody spoke up. Hecabe is a rogue Jerohanai who leads several packs, and we believe he's the one who landed here on Kero. Some embedded moles we've had among the ex-Covenant think that Hecabe may have acquired the control device in question during one of the final battles of the war. He's apparently boasted of such. But it's taken him 6 years to sort out where to go to unlock its power. He must have finally figured out about the hive here. And this hive here. So no one knew about it? Jai asked wearily. Van Eekhout took that question. There's a Forerunner structure deep underground on the outskirts of Soraka. Judging by Oni seismic scans before the reoccupation of Soraka, It matches the design of the only other known hive, but we believe that this structure has the potential to store hundreds of thousands of Sharkoi, a scale unlike anything we've ever seen. We don't think the Sanshayum knew it even existed. They tended to misinterpret a lot about Forerunner artifacts. An understatement, Melody muttered. Hecabe must have obtained new knowledge of the hive's location. And that led him here, Vanikout said. And you just let people come back to Soraka. And Sangheili, Adriana said. Settle here. And all the time knowing this was down there. We couldn't stop the planet's refugees from resettling without a major political upheaval from those who felt like the UNSC had abandoned them during the war, said Vanikout. It would have been a logistical and PR nightmare with some of the emerging separatist movements like the New Colonial Alliance. Think insurrection-scale problems. We also couldn't afford any of this leaking out. We figured the city would act as a buffer to discovery. But just in case, I've been here for the past few years. Monitoring. Vanikout looked slightly martyred. There were contingency plans. So, Melody said, looking right at Jai. There's a very angry Jirohanai chieftain in Soraka, who has just figured out how to break into a Forerunner facility buried below the planet. He plans to take control of the Sharkoi inside. There's a strong chance this poses a threat, not just to Kero, but to anywhere Hecabe can carry the Sharkoi in his vessels. You're now fully up to speed, Spartan. I had been trying to get back to warn the UNSC or Oni, but without a long-range communications relay, I'm afraid we're on our own. Are you willing to help us? Elise woke up as her head slipped forward and struck her desk. Utterly exhausted, she swore, rubbed her forehead and looked down at the data pane she'd been scanning. Lists of Surakan military who waited on the rooftops with shoulder-launched guided missiles. Pelicans and several sparrowhawks prepped to be rolled out of hardened bunkers, procured through backdoor channels years earlier. Probably through the New Colonial Alliance, Elise wasn't certain. Maps of militia positions around the occupied area also needed rechecking one last time. But they were all coiled and ready. The pane suddenly blinked several times, signaling an incoming call. Elise tapped it, and General Grace appeared. Our ships are about to enter orbit. The Jirohanai frigates that remain are pulling back from them rather than moving to engage. We have the high ground. Thank you, General. Keep me posted, Elise said, and cut the connection. Her vision blurred, doubles of everything she was looking at swimming around in front of her. How long had she been up? 3 days? The human body wasn't meant for this. She pulled out another stimulant patch and ripped it open. She rubbed it against her forearm and waited until the blurring faded away. The pressure behind her right eye took a step back. She got up to leave, and Lamar quickly appeared in the hall to stop her at the door. Elise, he said, with the Jirohanai frigates drawn back, this is our last chance. Lamar, Elise rubbed her scratchy eyes, I understand you want to do what you think is best. I won't hold this against you afterward. Forever, really. But I need you with me, by my side, to help us do this. I need your expertise. If you can't give it to me, let me know now. We can't afford to fight each other. Not with this threat on our doorstep. Her vice governor took a step back. I had to ask one last time. I have a conscience, Elise. She gave his shoulder a squeeze. I know. And I really appreciate where you're coming from. Thank you, Lamar, for all your counsel. Of course, when this was all over, she was going to ask for his resignation. Elise wouldn't be vindictive. She was better than that. But it was the end for him. Never mind the smile of reassurance she gave him now. That was to make sure he followed through until the enemy had been pushed back. The operations room's walls dripped screens patched into surveillance all over the city. They now had a decent line of sight on the rim of the massive crater the Jerohanai had glassed to get down into the Forerunner structure. Other screens showed feeds from orbit. Sorakan ships transmitted a bevy of new data as they waited to head planetside. Two generals sat in the room, a variety of other militia officers and three aides. Everyone crammed in close, with those lesser in rank crouching in the corners out of the way while murmuring orders or requests into earpieces. "We are go for Operation Buzzhawk," General Kapoor said. "Good," said Elise. "Let's send these Jerohanai back to where they came from." On her orders, the Sorakan ships began to descend from orbit and break for the surface. Chapter 14. Rajka's assault team still consisted of the 16 trusted warriors he'd handpicked after fighting the traitorous Kaza to the death, while trapped in the wreckage of his own command bridge. Most of his crew was dead, either from the crash or by Tharza's wrath. Those who survived had only a handful of working vehicles, two ghosts, a specter, and a single phantom, salvaged from the debris of the unwavering discipline, and operated by a few of his most skilled Sangheili. This other group had separated from the main pack and methodically picked their way to the outskirts of the Ult Desert in order to divert and delay their pursuers, while Rajka's own force raced ahead. This lean, fast-moving fighting force had found the remains of the Spartan shuttle quickly. From there they continued to follow their enemies across the desert. Yet it hadn't been enough, because now Tharz had finally caught up to Rajka before the Spartans could be dealt with. Rajka's best were not enough to take on the 100-strong enemy Sangheili arrayed on the dune tops around them, and any communication with the few vehicles they had would only give up their location. If they stood any chance for survival, he would have to wait on recalling them. Tharz's own phantom gunship had thundered overhead in the early morning darkness as they approached the mesa, where Rajka had tracked the Demon Three. Tharz's troops dropped to the ground and quickly formed a broad semicircle around Rajka's smaller force, all shadows scattered across the dunes. Rajka held a dune top of his own, for what little good it did. At least he wasn't positioned down below and between the dunes, forced to look up at Tharz and his conspirators. "Can we escape?" Daga asked. "No, we will not be cowards." Rajka looked back in the direction Tharz had not blocked off. There would be something out there, waiting. Ships with bigger guns. Tharz would crow for eternity if he killed Rajka in the process of retreat, the shameful end his enemy dreamed of. Tharz trudged up to the top of the nearest dune across from them. "Greetings, cousin," Tharz shouted from a safe distance. Several of his heavily armored commanders moved quickly to stand at his side. "I see you have paused. Do the Demon Three worry you?" Rajka looked toward the wall of rock ahead of them. "We are studying the enemy's keep," he said. "It is a human-made base, hidden from sight, and it will have defenses. We need to know how many are inside, or if we can lay a trap for them when they leave." For many it would have been difficult to discern the human structure embedded in the mountainside, but Rajka had seen enough of Rakoi, and of this vast desert in particular, not to be fooled. He knew what was real and natural, and what wasn't. Tharz made a sound of amusement and disdain. "You no longer have any ships. You have few to command an attack. Rajka, right now, I see only the dead standing before me. I have enough to take my revenge." "Revenge for all," Rajka said. "Possibly," Tharz said. "But if Sangheili attack a human facility, it is a strike against the humans' government. You are willing to die fighting for vengeance. We who live after your glorious deed will be the ones who suffer the consequences of this, however. What will the humans do to us on this world afterward? This, Rajka thought, was uncharacteristically forward-thinking by Tharz. Then again, maybe not. Tharz always made sure to take care of his own hide. You don't wish to see the Demon Three dragged to justice? Rajka shouted, letting rage seep into his voice. After the family we lost to them. Our nephews dead. Our traditions erased. The history of our peoples brought to nothing with the destruction of our home. The key was your world too, cousin. Oh, I want this, Tharz said, his voice silky and thoughtful despite the distance. But I puzzle over the more effective way to kill them, without upsetting the humans who will arrive soon. You have thoughts on this, Rajka said. I offer you a bargain, Tharz said. We will let you attack, but you will spare any humans inside other than the Demon Three. Once you have accomplished your task, we will rush in and rescue the remaining humans from you. So that was why Tharz surrounded and stopped him instead of striking directly. Rajka made a show of nodding thoughtfully. And then you will kill me and my warriors. Tharz spread his arms. An unfortunate consequence of the fighting, he said. I will tell the humans that you were sympathizers with one of the Covenant sects that is causing them problems. These days, that would be easy to believe. But all Sangheili will know you died in glory, cousin. And my previous offer stands. I will allow your bloodline to live on. Given the circumstances, it was a generous offer, Rajka knew. And even though Tharz was a traitorous wretch, with so many eyes on him for such a public proclamation, Rajka doubted Tharz would slaughter his bloodline when back at the city of Rak. Tharz would likely attempt to claim to have killed the Demon Three alongside Rajka and steal a share in the glory, of course. So before him was a choice. Run out into the desert, away from Tharz, and die at the hands of 100 former brothers. Or attack the human base and perish when Tharz swooped in afterward. Rajka looked at his 16 trusted warriors. They were poised, preparing for the battle to erupt at any moment, but also waiting for him to make the first move. Dagger caught his eye and nodded. Any which way, his eyes glittered. Their lives were gripped in his hands, Rajka knew. But more importantly, their legacies all were being decided right in this moment. What would be sung about them for generations hung on whatever he chose to do next. Very well. I will attack and spare the other humans, Rajka said with grudging respect. It is a worthy plan. It would certainly give anyone under him their honor. And it would allow him to finally exact revenge on the Demon Three. Perhaps he could also silence the envoy, who brought this all on him to begin with. And it might even protect whatever remained of their lineage left in Rak. Might, he thought heavily. A small word from which to hang the fate of lives. Rajka waved his fighters to move with him. Toward the large numbers of Sangheili in front of them who now opened up a path to let them through. As they passed, Rajka turned on his armor's stealth camouflage. Let us find a way into this human keep and then kill the Demon Three, Rajka said to Dagger as they left Tharz behind them and walked toward the mesa. And end this once and for all. In the ready room, Jai crouched on the floor with his back against the wall. Melody sat at the side of the table on a chair a few feet away. You are persuasive, Jai told her, but I can't convince this team to do anything right now. Not after what we've been through. We were forced to make a big decision out there on our own. That call is still breaking us. I gave you the information so that you'd hear what was at stake. Your team listened. That's all I can ask. Melody leaned forward. What are you going to do, Jai 006? She was using his number on purpose. A call to duty, Jai thought. She was good, the envoy. And she wasn't wrong. The long, silent inner turmoil that he'd carried across the desert had eased slightly when she'd made the request that they assist. I'm going to try to help you. This is what I was built for, wasn't it? This is the information we have, what you gave us. That's a hell of a fog of war. Doesn't seem like there's much of a question. I truly believe this is the right fight, Jai, Melody said. I wouldn't have put everything on the table if I didn't think you guys should know it all. I know. He cocked his head. But believing something strongly didn't make a person right. Insane asylums were filled with people who felt the same way. Conviction was a poor substitute for tactical thinking. But the intel you just shared is the reason why I'm going to do this. What about the rest of Gray Team? She asked. What happened on... Jai paused as he struggled with the way he'd phrased those words. What we did took the key. I don't know how we'll ever come to terms with that. How I will. Yes. Maybe it has broken us. But right now, because of the stakes, because of what's at risk, we'll fight. That we know how to do. An explosion shook the rock walls. Alarms blared. The comfortable brightness snapped off, replaced with emergency red lighting. Van Eekhout leaned around the doorframe with a BR-55 battle rifle in hand. Something violently breached the south entrance. Sensors show mass, but no visuals. Computers are running through visual analysis, but they're already inside. The Sangheili had arrived. Jai stood up. Active camouflage, he said. Probably, Van Eekhout agreed. And once you get close enough, even to a shielded bunker like this, their sensors would be able to show them enough to get in. Adriana skidded to the door behind Van Eekhout. We need to get to your armory, she said. Mike thudded in to join them. Sangheili? Yes, Jai said, and looked back to Van Eekhout. The armory? There's no time, Van Eekhout said. He tossed the BR-55 at Jai. Take my rifle. You can do more with this than I can. You need to get out of here now. No, Jai said. We're Spartans. We fight. Van Eekhout stepped inside the ready room and squared off against Jai. Really? Then get to Saraka. Because fighting here doesn't help anyone. It just wastes time and resources. But we sure as hell need your help fighting Hecabe before he releases the Sharkoi on everyone and everything we're all trying to protect. Jai glanced at Mike, then Adriana, who shrugged. The only boy has a point, she said. Van Eekhout pointed down the corridor. Here's what you need to do. Follow this corridor. Take the second tunnel on your left. It dead ends on a shielded hatch. Tap the code 458618 to open it. There's a ladder down the cliff face and a warthog hidden at the bottom. Drive east 30 kilometers until you hit an old stream bed. Then drive along that south until you get to Saraka. Other than that, good luck. Melody? Adriana asked. She can't make it down the ladder in time like you can, Van Eekhout said. Melody wrapped Mike's armor. Get out, she said. They won't touch me. Van Eekhout and I are worth more alive than dead. You're the ones they have a vendetta against. Go. They're in here already. Gray Team took off down the corridor. Jai glanced back. Leaving someone behind just felt wrong, he thought. Melody watched the three Spartans turn the corridor. Once they were gone, she said to Van Eekhout, We need to fall back to the armory and bolt ourselves in. There is no armory. We had a single battle rifle and I just gave it to them. Van Eekhout ushered her into the ready room and closed the door behind her. He tapped a password into the screen by the entrance. That's not good, Melody said. Those Sangheili are coming for us, and they're all pretty angry. It won't take long for them to find their way here and break into this room. Vanny Count walked to the back of the room and sat down. He put his feet up on the table. He wasn't wearing any shoes. He must have rolled out of his bed and come running. "They're always angry," he said. "At this point, which one do you think is coming through that door?" Explosions rocked the installation. A bit of dust trickled down from the ceiling. "I took the Spartans away from Rajka. He might kill me for that," Melody said. "If it's Thars, he might kill me too for choosing to help Rajka all this time. They might kill you as well." The blade of an energy sword burst through the door. Embedded electronics spat sparks and hot cinders. It wouldn't take long now. "So, death at either door," Vanny Count said, almost cheerfully. The dead serious Oni agent had faded away to be replaced once more by the friendly Vanny Count. She wondered which was the facade and which was real. "Maybe." Melody stepped back from the door. "I knew I was screwed the moment I got assigned to this backwater planet." The door blew inward and sliced through the conference table in the middle of the ready room. Thars stepped through, energy rifle aimed at Melody's head. "Envoy," he growled, "you do not even try to fight us. A dishonorable capture. I expected no less." Chapter 15. Hecabe, eyes closed, stood in front of the massive Sharkoi. He swayed slightly to the left, feeling the presence in his mind still seeping further and further in. The fearsome creature, just a few meters away, also slowly shifted its body to the left, in perfect synchrony with Hecabe. He could feel the Sharkoi. Its potential. It was a speck of will deep inside the universe, toward which he extended his own mind. Though the Hecabe of just hours ago would not have understood these words properly, because the words were only abstractions that didn't quite capture the true feeling of control. That Hecabe was gone, vaporized the moment the Forerunner technology had bitten down through his forehead. Yet, there was a seed of the will and desire of the old Hecabe that still lived here, like a flame in the distance. He had learned so much in these last few hours. An unknown element deep in the substrate of this machine's reach had embraced Hecabe and educated him, a presence of something that had taken on this mantle long before Hecabe. An ancient whisper of experience, or memory, guiding him. Something that had touched the Sharkoi long ago, and had left some residue. "Here is how to dwell in this new consciousness," it told him, if he strained to listen. Those ancient snatches of memory gave Hecabe the glimpse of vicious surgical devices, cutting deep into Sharkoi skulls to crack them open. Intelligent Forerunner machines delicately reaching down past viscera to stamp implants securely into brain tissue. Implants of incomprehensible power that could effectively control the Sharkoi. It was a challenging process. A desperate gamble and complete forsaking of ethical standards long held by the Forerunners. They were attempting to create soldiers out of a half-witted but physically imposing species, beings who had, for some inscrutable reason, proved completely resilient to the flood plague. They were the perfect weapon. But they needed guidance. They needed to be controlled. And through a deft balance of stimuli to specific cerebral tissue and a burst of engineered hormones, the one who wore this strange device had near absolute governance over the creature's physical functionality. And now, here, it meant Hecabe could control the powerful thing before him. The Sharkoi raised its fists into the air. Ekabe could see it with his own eyes. But he saw himself from the Sharkoi's eyes as well. The neural twitches translated from the Sharkoi through its implants and then back to Hecabe. Looking down from above, the Sharkoi saw him as a small thing, tiny and weak. And Hecabe also saw himself standing in front of the Sharkoi from the perspective of three more of them that now stood off to the side. They had been awakened and had emerged from their stasis fields. Had he done that? Yes. Some part of him had. It was a part muddled with the memories of his own mind that was now fusing with the power buried throughout his skull. The three Sharkoi stepped forward to flank Hecabe. From all the Sharkoi, he could now look back over his shoulder, where Oath of Fury still rested, and he could see the Jirohanai packs fearfully staring at him and the mysterious creatures. The ground shook as something far overhead exploded. Even the Sharkoi could feel that. Dust drifted through the air in lazy patterns. A Nexus, clearly grabbing hold of his courage, approached them. "The humans are striking back at us," he shouted. To Hecabe's own body, it sounded like a distant murmur from behind a closed door. But the Sharkoi could hear it. So through them, Hecabe could as well. Ground-based weapons thudded away at their excavation site. "Let them strike," Hecabe said. A Nexus scrabbled back, eyes wide. The words had come, deep and terrifying, from the Sharkoi nearest to him instead of Hecabe, who still had his back to a Nexus. The words were slurred, coming from an alien mouth, but recognizable and filled with vitality. "We will be lost," a Nexus said. The stench of fear roiled off him. "The Phobane is taking damage from human ships." "We are not lost," Hecabe now shouted with anger through all of the Sharkoi. The packs collectively took several more steps back, edging closer to the bridge they had come across. One of the Sharkoi moved to release its brethren, which staggered out from their containment fields, freed from eternal suspension. "Tell Phobane to stand its ground at all costs. No one enters the Citadel while we are down here. No one." He would need more Sharkoi to put a stop to the human counterattack. He would need more Sharkoi for all that he had planned. Hecabe growled in frustration. He would have preferred to have had additional time to learn how to properly control these new charges. But this was time he didn't have. "Accept everything," an instinct counseled him. "Stop fighting. Stop trying to bend their minds. Your ways will not hold here. Direct them. Guide them. Unleash them. Be them." Hecabe roared and punched the ground with massive clawed fists. He saw this through other eyes. It was no longer Hecabe the Jirohanai, but Hecabe the Sharkoi. The Sharkoi's arms struck with the same force as a gravity hammer, rippling the air with energy and concussive force. A curious Jirohanai warrior that had approached too close now flew back, tumbling into the air away from the point of impact and over the edge of the bridge. As the luckless Jirohanai screamed, dissolving in the lava, Hecabe opened his own eyes. "Release more of them," he shouted at the wind in his mind, as the human bombs above his head thudded and exploded against the top of the Forerunner structure. whether he could control the Sharkoi or not. It was time to unleash as many as he could. It was the only way to stop his enemies now.
Outside the Oni facility, Jai fell 100 meters to the ground and hit solid rock. Pulverized pieces of debris flew away from the point of impact. The gel inside his Mjolnir armor hardened to protect him. The Spartan rolled and tumbled with the fall, bouncing off a boulder and sliding down scree until he came to a bruising, dizzying stop.
"Check in," he groaned.
"The warthog is up against the rock under the ladder," Mike said.
"Here,"
Adriana grunted. Jai stood up and spotted the warthog. It had jet-black paint like others he'd seen Oni deploy, but it was immediately clear that, over the past 6 years, it had seen a number of design changes to its chassis. Adriana already limped toward it. Mike had bounced a bit farther on down and was scrambling over the rocks, heading for Jai.
"I don't like leaving the envoy," Adriana said,
clambering into the warthog's rear bed and setting up on the Vulcan anti-aircraft gun. Surprised, Jai said, "You think we should head back up?"
"It feels like we abandoned her," Adriana said, echoing Jai's thoughts. "And we don't really know how those Sangheili will react."
"But they know more about that situation than we do," Mike said. "These things the Jiral Hanai are looking for are clearly a greater threat. Sometimes..." Jai fired the warthog up, interrupting him. Mike immediately attempted to access the vehicle's command console to assess its capabilities. But Jai didn't pull the warthog out from under the shade of the rock recess. He turned in his seat to face the two other Spartans.
"Listen, we've already been through hell. What happened on Glaki? I take the blame for that. I'm responsible for pushing the team in that direction and not waiting for more intel. That's my fault. We're in a similar spot right now, without clear direction. So I need to make sure we're all on the same page. I need to make sure this is a decision we make as a team."
"We're going to Soraka," Adriana said after a moment. "Even if I don't agree with leaving the envoy behind, even if we're in the dark about what we should do next, if the Jiral Hanai are attacking humans in the city, that's an easy fight to jump into."
"Yeah," Mike said. "We're still Gray Team. It's us against everything else, same as it ever was. Even when it's all gone to shit, we head toward the fight, not away from it, and we'll figure it out when we get there. That's what we do."
Jai didn't say anything, just nodded and accelerated the warthog out onto the dunes, headed east at full speed. Melody Azikiwe stood defiantly as Tharz stalked around the ready room.
"And you swear you have not seen Rajka Kassan?"
The Sangheili seemed puzzled. Again, she shook her head. In the corner of the room, Commander Greg Van Eekhout hung from between two Sangheili soldiers' arms, having been bruised and battered by Tharz for the past 5 minutes.
"I have not seen Rajka since orbit, shipmaster," Melody said quietly, in flawless Sangheili.
Tharz kicked the ruins of the conference table.
"Again! He runs from me again!"
Tharz had apparently arrived expecting to find a very different situation. This didn't make sense. Last time she was with Rajka, he was preparing to fight Tharz to the death. For some reason, Tharz had now expected the Kaidan to be here, according to some mutual plan.
"What the hell is going on?
You still refuse to tell me where the Demon Three have gone?"
Tharz stopped pacing. He looked thoughtfully over at Van Eekhout. He pulled out his energy sword. It flared to life. Melody stepped forward.
"Shipmaster, what are you doing?"
One of his commanders backhanded her in response. Melody sprawled to the floor, hitting the pieces of table. She scrambled back up and wiped blood from her upper lip with a sleeve.
"Humans will find horrible things done to you too. Atrocities that they will believe Rajka committed in this station. And I will apologize to them profusely that I was not able to reach you in time to stop it," Tharz said.
He arced the energy sword through the air,
slicing first into Vanikout's head, then shoving the blade slowly down to cut his body in two. The Sangheili on either side stepped back in disgust, as each half of the remains of the Oni agent fell by their respective feet. Melody stifled a scream. Tharz turned back to her.
My cousin Rajka feels there can be a peace between our kind, envoy. But after all that has happened, do you also believe it? Do you think you can let go of seeing an ally killed like this before you? Will that hatred with which you now stare at me be something you could dam up? I'm willing to do so.
Melody tried not to look at the ruined body of Commander Vanikout. She swallowed bile and stared directly back up at Tharz's pale, unblinking eyes.
We have to be, or all we'll do is destroy each other. There will be more war, more hell.
Tharz scoffed at her.
What do you know of war's hell, envoy? Sitting in your comfortable negotiation rooms and dining with ambassadors as you travel around in comfort. You are soft, and you talk all the time.
I am Kenyan, Melody snapped at him. I was there when the Covenant attacked the East African Protectorate. I have lost more than you suspect, Shipmaster. And yet, here I am, fighting for peace. Fighting for the survival of our species. I'll fight for it until I die. But never lecture me about loss when all my family and friends lie dead under glass by the actions of your kind.
These are just words to me. You do know what horrors the Demon Three unleashed. Well after our peoples had established peace.
Tharz raised his voice.
Do you know about Glikki?
Yes. I know what they did.
Melody defiantly refused to close her eyes. And if he killed her right now, she would stare him down until the last moment.
And yet, since your kind is without justice, you still will not give them over to me,
Tharz said. I assume they run for the human city, Soraka.
Which route do they take?
Melody swallowed and looked at the remains of Vanikout, the sight of his mangled body and the smell of cauterized flesh threatening to overwhelm her.
I will not tell you that.
She tensed, waiting for the killing strike. Tharz cocked his head.
You know I will find them. We found you here.
If you find them,
your fight will be with them,
Melody said. She was doing her best to remain steady.
Just keep him talking,
she thought. She was only trying to buy time at this point. The longer Tharz stood here, the better chance the Spartans had.
Do you see?
Tharz announced to the other Sangheili in the ready room.
All humans are the same. This one protects the Demon Three. What difference does it make whether they killed Sangheili innocents after we had laid down our weapons, or if it was her that did the killing? She helps them now. Perhaps she even worked with those who plotted the genocide of Glikki back then. You see how all humans are complicit.
And have you not stood in the command bridge of a ship that murdered innocent civilians by the millions? At the order of the prophets?
Melody asked.
Are you truly any different than the Demon Three?
Guard your tongue, human.
Tharz raised his energy sword and turned to her, his voice calm.
I will now ask my questions a final time. You will answer, or suffer an end the same as your friends.
Melody took a deep breath as she tore herself away from staring at Vanikout's body and back directly to Tharz. She needed to keep the Sangheili engaged, but she wasn't sure how much longer she could do that.
Take a big gamble, then, she thought. Tell him everything you're not supposed to.
Do you know what the Jirilhanae you allied with are really here for?
why they really agreed to come to this planet? You have spent all of your time asking how you might take control of Rak from Rojka. But since you brought Hecabe here, this has been the wrong question, she said. Tharis did not respond. Melody continued. I need you to think about threats to your people, your keeps, here on Rakoi right now. You need to know what the Jirohanai are planning to do. They will destroy everything you are fighting for. They are going to release something horrible onto not just this world, but Sanghelios, Earth, everywhere. Tharis pushed the very tip of his energy sword into her shoulder. Melody screamed as skin and muscles sizzled. Tharis stepped forward. I do not care about the Jirohanai. Where are the Demon Three? Melody tried to grab his forearm, but was struck from the side. She gasped as the wind was knocked out of her and she rolled into the wall. Something invisible had grabbed her. She could see the edges of whatever held her down shifting as it moved, the other side of the room gliding over it. It was active camouflage. Traitor! Tharis bellowed. Melody's head snapped as she was picked up and the invisible figure sprinted for the door. Plasma fire splashed hot against the frame. They veered down the corridor and more invisible forms started firing back as Tharis's own Sangheili spilled out of the room to give chase. Tharis's fighters ducked back inside as ignited plasma grenades flew through the air to stick to the floor in front of them. Explosions rocked the corridor and a powerful blast of heat roiled down between the walls toward the invisible fighters. The active camouflage flickered and failed as a large form appeared crouching, protecting Melody from the explosion. Melody gasped, staring at a familiar Sangheili face. Rojka? Rojka's fighters appeared around her, their active camouflage deactivating and their armor shields flaring. Rojka yanked her down the same tunnel the Spartans had used to escape the facility. Melody could see the desert through a hole the Sangheili had blown in the now glowing rock. He continued running for it, holding Melody all the while, his fighters falling in behind them. They were laying down covering fire back at Tharis. Rojka, go! I can't survive that jump, Melody shouted. They obviously weren't going to be using the ladder down. Trust me, envoy, he told her. Then his strong Saurian legs tensed. They had to be hundreds of feet above the desert. No, wait! Rojka leapt out into the hot void. They hit something a second later with a metallic bang. Melody opened her eyes and saw that Rojka held on to the bay door of a phantom dropship with one hand and her waist with another. He pushed her into the vessel's open bay while it drew away from the mesa's rock wall. Rojka's fighters were jumping out of the hole for the ground below, some of them finding purchase on the same dropship. Others fell toward the ground, hitting it in an explosion of dust and leaping into a run. More of his own soldiers awaited in a small assortment of ground vehicles 100 meters from the mesa's base. Why the rescue? Melody asked, shouting as air whipped at them in the bay. You know where the Demon Three are going, Rojka said, letting go of Melody. We came to retrieve that information from you. Then I witnessed Tharis renege on his word to protect you. And there is also the interesting query you raised about the Jirohanai. You're still hunting Grey Team? Melody shouted back, hyper aware that all Rojka would have to do was shove her out of the bay and she would plummet to the desert floor to a certain death. Will you be trying to torture that out of me? We now have little time. I suspect I already know where the Demon Three will be. Soraka. What I require now is more information about the Jirohanai. Were you being honest, human? You were claiming to warn Tharis of them. You said all Sangheili here on Rakoi are in danger. I have a duty to protect them. They are mine.
These few vehicles are the last of what remains of discipline. All that I have left to protect my people. Tell me more, envoy. Why was there such a human facility hidden here in the desert? What is really happening?
Melody looked back at the mesa through the open bay. Pain tore through her shoulder at the movement, making her gasp. The seared skin under her ripped and bloody diplomat corps uniform was cauterized, but not ready for her to move. Rajka's leap had torn some of the charred skin apart, and now Melody could feel blood trickling down under her arm. The mesa's entire rocky top jumped up slightly into the air, disturbing dust and sand. Then explosions ripped through the space above and the rock face, and it imploded down into a giant cavity. The entire facility swallowed up with a belch of fire. Rajka looked back, somewhat startled.
What was that?
I think that was Commander Vanny Count's last gift. She'd always dismissed rumors about Oni installations that would self-destruct if they couldn't confirm that the station's authorized keeper was alive. She'd wondered if she'd been playing for time inside a ticking bomb.
Indeed. That will slow Thars down, Rajka said approvingly. They watched the fireball over the desert slowly dissipate. You think he survived? Melody asked.
Doubtless. Rajka leaned out the open bay as smoke curled upward from what remained of the mesa.
Thars would not have wasted any time exploring the facility for clues. He is too impatient. He would have left the structure to get to his vehicles. He will be pursuing us shortly. I'll be sending a banshee and a few of my fighters off in another direction to confuse him.
With a grunt of pain, Melody moved to stand beside Rajka and figure out the next decision she had to make. Rajka had been an ally, but ultimately he was Sangheili. If Oni had requested the utmost secrecy from her, prohibiting her from telling the Spartans about the Sharkoi without authorization, what would happen if she told Rajka?
Nothing good.
Here, in the middle of battle, she needed to make a choice that might have far greater implications down the line. Could Rajka be trusted? How long had she really known the Sangheili Kaidan and Fleetmaster? Was it too late to even matter? Rajka realized she'd moved. He snaked his head down to be level with hers.
You told Thars he asked the wrong question, Rajka said. What question should I be asking?
Melody looked from the burning facility to Rajka's large, unblinking eyes.
The question you should be asking is, what are the Sharkoi?
Chapter 16. The attack on the Jirohanai cruiser hovering over the edge of the city began from the ground. The Sorakan militia had kept a dozen Kodiak mobile artillery tanks in a reserve underground. The large, heavily armored vehicles were easy to navigate through the streets, and quick to reposition themselves where needed. When ready to fire, they moored themselves to the ground by stabilizers to launch powerful anti-armor rounds at targets. The Kodiaks now opened up, hitting the cruiser's well-defended belly all at once. But this was just a diversion. Jirohanai patrolling gunships, a collection of phantoms and the cruel machines the brutes referred to in their native tongue as gravemakers, chattered loudly as they pressed toward the Kodiaks, opening up a mixed barrage of directed energy and searing hot metal projectiles. As the positions of the Jirohanai shifted, six pelicans swung in from the Ult Desert, flying low and kicking up sand as they rose up toward the cruiser, while the brute gunships engaged the mobile artillery and the anti-air squads protecting them, and firefights ripped the streets apart. The handful of Sorakan aircraft began the first wave of attacks. They banked hard as they climbed along the enemy ship's hull, gaining altitude to jettison the highest non-nuclear payload Soraka had in its reserves, directly onto the cruiser. The vessel's shields shimmered under the bombardment, but continued to hold. Wising up to this diversion,
A number of Jirohanai phantoms disengaged from the street fighting in order to deal with the Sorakan aircraft. They climbed swiftly into the sky, attempting to cut the pelicans off. The pelicans at first dodged ferocious waves of enemy firepower from the cruiser's point defense system, which halted abruptly as the Jirohanai's own gunships veered too close. The pelicans took advantage of that to break free and launch back down toward the surface. The phantoms would have likely pursued, but were frozen by what they now saw in Kero's sky. From the east, three glowing fireballs fell from the sky, leaving long trails of smoke. From the west, eight Sorakan merchant ships emerged from the cover of clouds and began pummeling the Jirohanai cruiser with their own point defense weaponry. The concentrated firepower lit up the side of the cruiser. "This is the tricky bit," General Kapoor said, observing the entire battle from the wall of screens in the underground operations center. General Grace sat nearby, arms folded, eyes fixed on the scene, and Elise stood just behind her. The Sorakan ships were also a diversion. The three balls of light that plummeted toward Soraka from the east were the real attack. Several half-mined asteroids had been jockeyed into stable orbits between Kero and its moon, and then brought dangerously close to the suborbital plane, before being shoved out of orbit by the four remaining Sorakan ships. They used an advanced corralling technique with hull-mounted magnetic grapplers and terraform vices, a procedure that had, up until just the last hour, only been untested theory. Now it was the real thing. It was a huge gamble. If the Jirohanai cruiser fled, the Sorakans would be effectively bombing themselves. But if the encroaching ships could keep the Jirohanai pinned in place just long enough, they would never be able to counter the three giant space rocks. The front line of Sorakan ships continued to lay into the cruiser. It responded, a devastating cloud of blinding white fire that quickly ripped four of the vessels apart. The survivors continued unabated, targeting the shields, and the Jirohanai cruiser bore the brunt of a concentrated attack from the ships above and artillery below. More focused on the threat the Sorakan ships posed, the enemy ship didn't acknowledge the burning asteroids cutting through the atmosphere toward it until it was too late. The closest Sorakan vessels pulled off to the side just at the last second as three chunks of metallic space rock struck the Jirohanai cruiser in quick succession. The first one failed to penetrate, but megatons of kinetic energy had suddenly been released. Its shields flickered, already stressed by the incessant barrage dealt to it by the Sorakan ships. The second rock exploded against the cruiser, and a brilliantly white fireball blossomed on the hull. General Kapoor pumped a fist in the air. There it goes. The third rock struck. The Jirohanai cruiser appeared to fold in midair, gushing blue and white flames and canting over as it dipped out over the far edge of the crater, a giant wounded beast trying to escape the harassing Sorakan ships, which now descended and began nipping at it. The Jirohanai cruiser finally pitched to the ground just outside Soraka and crumpled between the city and the rocky hills that led out into the Ult. The rumbling sound followed for those underground a few long seconds after. Governor, General Grace turned in her chair to face Elise. I'm proud to say we have taken back Soraka. Aides and military personnel clapped and cheered. And even the tired generals took a moment to smile. Elise stared at the screen, looking at different feeds of the Jirohanai ship burning at the edge of its crater. The horrible monster had already dug its own grave. The cruiser had been hovering above the city for so long that it seemed odd to see the sky now clear. Grace started giving commands, drop ships to be landed on the city's outskirts to release extra troops. Militia to be moved down toward the massive hole in the earth and flush out whatever remained. I don't want a single Jirohanai walking around the city. We start mopping them up now. Travis Pope put a hand on Elise's arm. This is a triumph, Governor. She'd done it. She'd fought them back, kept the city alive, and steered her people through hell. Elise numbly looked around the room. She should be celebrating, but her nerves felt too raw. The idea of not being focused on one emergency after another